Hello and hi. Welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Jonathan Bradshaw.
And Jonathan is here to give us a field report from the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival. And a lot of you may not have heard Jonathan on this show before, but you've definitely seen some of his online instigations, discussions about various pop culture or sci-fi related things. So say hello to everyone, Jonathan.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a great day.
Yes, Jonathan is, why don't you describe your aficionado, your connection to the genre world of entertainment that we so crave?
Well, specifically with sci-fi and horror, I've been following it since I was a kid. I'm a child of the 80s, so all of the pop culture shows, books, fan fiction, comics, TV, all of it I've been heavily into since I was a kid. So following everything from Star Trek, Battlestar, B5, horror, sci-fi, speculative fiction. And as I've gotten older, just broadening that. So reading, following, watching pretty much everything I could cram into my ears or get in front of my face on a screen or on the page. So I go way back to reading Fangoria, picking it up on the newsstand when it came out, following Starlog Publications, reading the legions of fan fiction and novels for Star Trek and such. So I've been following it for the majority of my life. So it's pretty much where I fit in.
Yes. So a shared love of science fiction, horror, and comic books.
Indeed.
Has brought you to being my eyes and ears on the ground in Brooklyn, New York, last week for the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival. How was that experience? Be honest.
The festival itself was pretty well organized, pretty well thought out. Very exciting. They made a point of making sure there was a broader conversation in terms of the kind of horror that people were going to be able to see. So there's a lot of stuff filmed and directed by people who were in Europe. So we have Eastern Europe, Sweden, things like that. And a lot of people taking different takes on the genre. So that was really exciting to see, especially considering this is something that they want to continue doing yearly. So being able to see not just American horror cinema, European directors, female directors, that alone was exciting and a big draw, despite, you know, what I wound up seeing being a lot closer to, you know, my interest. But that is very exciting to see because there are ebbs and flows, and especially in terms of horror. You have every year, every few years or so, a resurgence. So people pick up a franchise or people want to reinvent on an older theme. But this really gives you the impression that they're injecting some new blood, no pun intended, into the genre. So that's going to be really exciting and fun to see.
Yeah, I'm hoping we get to see a little bit more creative and carefully thought out studio love, because the popularity and critical acclaim of It, the reimagining of It, seems to have caught a lot of studio execs by surprise, shall we say? And it sounds like the recently released, actually this past weekend, Happy Death Day, is sort of the horror take on Groundhog Day, did better box office than Blade Runner, and is actually getting a lot of positive buzz. So it may continue that trend.
Hopefully. We've been talking offline here and there about, you know, the democratization of not just the medium, but especially the genres that comprise that medium. So as more people play with it, as more people, you know, put their own takes and spins on things, you will have a much more fresher perspective. And so people will be a little bit more daring in taking risks. They'll push it into other directions that we hadn't thought of or were waiting to see and been clamoring for it. And now we'll get the opportunity to finally be able to see that as they play around more with it.
I hope the trend continues because Blumhouse has been very creative. Mm-hmm. Even on stuff that didn't thrill me, mm-hmm. it was a creative endeavor. And now in, you know, 1 year they have Get Out and now Happy Death Day. I'm hoping they continue to lead the charge, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also whether they're smaller, newer studios or more established, hopefully people being able to see films, not just at film festivals or in the theater, people being able to see it on Netflix or stream it, those mm-hmm. avenues, as they expand and widen even more, we'll get a taste of more of that because there will be, I hope, less of a barrier to entry in terms of, you know, funding, in terms of attached talent, you know, having a name, and people who've been able to really make a name for themselves or to have people look at their work in other mediums and then transition it through there, that will hopefully expand even more. I'm looking forward to, say, for instance, Stranger Things. I cannot wait to binge watch that later on this month, I think. So things like that, being able to look forward to that and really just consume it and see where people are pushing things in other directions. Shout out to the Duffer Brothers. They grew up in the same town that I grew up in, so
nice.
Have a lot of love for the guys from Durham. So
cool. So what you got to see at the festival, the Kane Hodder documentary To Hell and Back. I know you were really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
So I thought it was a cheat. This originally started as an Indiegogo project. So it was funded by a couple of guys who were really big fans of the genre, big fans of Kane Hodder as well. I come into this many, many years earlier, 1988, Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood came out. So this is the first time that I actually was kind of almost of age, not quite, to be able to see horror movies, and had followed, you know, all the standards. You know, you have what I consider the big three. You have Freddy, you have Michael Myers, you have Jason. And so growing up, being a preteen and then a teenager, really starting to follow these movies. So I got to see The New Blood. I thought it was awesome. And on the spot, became a huge fan of Kane Hodder. And continue to follow him through movies and watching him on the Arsenio Hall show and doing other things. A huge fan. I continue watching movies through my adulthood, following things here and there, but never got a really good understanding of Kane Hodder. I always knew that he had done other things. He had been a stuntman. He did acting. And being fixated specifically on the Friday franchise, wanted to know more. And also, you know, just for prurient interest, wanted to know more about the story of how Freddy versus Jason did not have him in the role of Jason. So any Friday the 13th fan, if you're a hardcore fan, you have an abiding irritation about the fact that he was, however, whoever was part of the story wants to cut it. He was passed over. They didn't really think he was right for the role. They wanted to go in a different direction. However that happens, that story is intriguing, interesting. So that was an easy decision to make, to go see it, to learn more about him, the process by which he got into the industry, he got the role, maintained the role. There have been a list of other actors, Warrington Gillette, Ari Lehman, Ted White, a bunch of guys who have played Jason. But you have, in 88, a complete reimagining, arguably, of that character. Many people will say, you know, this is essentially a dumb pipe character. You know, walks around, moves very stiffly, no words, no face, no way to really interact, to really be scared of him, other than these way over the top, gross, outlandish kills that are alternately forgettable, or as some critics of horror films will say, you know, reprehensible in portraying that kind of violence in society. Any horror film fan will tell you that these are indicative of the genre. They are not to be taken, you know, seriously, and that this is part of our shared culture, which was mentioned in the film, about us being scared, being able to share that experience, it being cathartic, and still be safe when you leave the theater. You essentially leave it there, all there in the theater. But really, you go in, and for that period of time, you go in, you're with a bunch of other people, you watch it, you're scared, you live the whole thing out, and it's, you know, a really good ride. So after seeing that and then seeing him in subsequent films, really being interested in him and his background. And so the movie, the documentary, essentially follows him from being a kid and growing up to being interested in doing film, being an extra. And his first film was with Elliot Gould and I forget who else. And he is going to school. He's, you know, playing on a high school basketball team, and he is bitten by the bug. So he's an extra in a couple of films. He really enjoys it, wants to do more, and continues doing it, and then transitions from that into doing stunts. Not to give too much away, but he, early on in his career, has a really terrible accident. And that essentially, no pun intended, marks him from that point going forward. How he deals with it, how he processes that, and how he continues to do work, being mindful of that. And so that alone was really very inspiring. He was very honest and very forthright and really very emotional in a way that I didn't expect. The juxtaposition of knowing his work on screen, his early work that I followed, and then, you know, the majority of it. Kane has a reputation for playing really rough and tumble guys, very violent, very aggressive, very powerful guys. But to see him talk humanly and openly about the injury, about his childhood, which includes a very difficult period of him being bullied. So the emotional and the mental stress and the toll it took on him, I think, especially now in our society, when we deal with that, we try to come to grips with it, we talk about it, but we don't really seem to get it right in terms of really zeroing out on the perspective of children who've been affected by that and how they carry that in their lives with them forward. So that was really poignant. I thought that it was going to be a lot more heavy in terms of the roles, but it really does a really nice job of blending all of these aspects of his life together. So it follows, it continues. There are interviews with a range of other people, fans, people in the industry. So Cassandra Peterson, who played Elvira, Bruce Campbell, another science fiction horror legend, played Ash in Evil Dead. And there are a couple of other directors as well who've worked with him over time, the director of Hatchet, the director of Halston, I think that's the name of the piece of work where he played himself. And it's centered around him losing the role of Jason for Freddy vs. Jason, which is essentially a comedy. So it follows, you know, his injury at 20, him going forward, really spending the time, 4 months of recovering in a hospital, I think in San Francisco. Don't shoot me if I'm wrong on that. Spending that time and really going through profound agony. He mentions something that is really true. He talks about doing this stunt for a local reporter, and they initially did the stunt, and it was on a hill near a lake. And so he said, I didn't really like the burn because it was close to the water, it was windy, and I didn't really think it would come off really well because the fire was dying down, there was wind involved, so he decides that he wants to do another shoot. At the last minute, he didn't want to admit that he didn't have enough money to get rubber cement as an accelerant to do the burn. So the reporter brings cement, and he, you know, puts it on, wraps himself, puts it on, and is holding a lighter in his arm, outstretched. and it winds up catching sooner than he wanted it to happen. So horrific burn. He tells that story about him getting to the hospital and being in this hospital that is ill-equipped, really, to handle the level of injury that he had in going through that process of essentially suffering. I mean, to hear it, I really encourage people to get a really good sense. It gives you a good sense of him, but also this period, which really started shaping the rest of what he did after. And his parents finally taking him to, I believe, San Francisco, to a burn unit there, where he is in recovery for a great deal of time after that. This really marks him. This, in addition to the bullying and him getting past the bullying and being able to put that somewhere and move forward, but also this horrific burn and the scarring going forward and still pursuing his craft. Really very interesting. It gives you, this guy's got such heart, and it was really fun to see the person that I followed for so long being one thing and then him being so very human. Very interesting. So he gets out, he continues his career. He meets John Carl Beekler, who directed films, had him do a stunt for, I think, the movie Prison. They continue working together, and in 88, Beekler has thought of him. It happens all the time in the industry. Somebody works with a couple of actors, and then they keep them in mind going forward, so they're able to do various other productions. Has him in mind for Jason Part 7, The New Blood, where he has an FX team put together, assembled, brings Kane in, and they do this process of Kane really redefining the role. In addition to Beekler and the FX team really redesigning Jason as a character. So elements that you see from 7 going forward, 7 until the ill-fated, however you like to put it, the ill-fated Jason X, Jason in space, people affectionately refer to. The whole presence of Jason, how he moves, his screen countenance, all of that is essentially redefined by Kane in those movies. And so it follows him through The New Blood. Jason goes to Manhattan, Jason goes to hell, Jason X. Interesting little tidbit in Jason Goes to Hell, which is famous for being dinged by fans. I'm one. I ding it here and there. I was watching, did a Friday the 13th party last week with a couple of friends, and my wife said, well, why don't we see, you know, watch Jason Goes to Hell? And I said, nah, because, you know, ultimately he's only on screen 10 minutes in the beginning and 10 minutes at the end. So really you don't get enough of him to really be meaningful. But at the end, there's this classic shot of Jason's mask in the dirt on the ground after he's been defeated. And a hand springs up out of the ground, and it's Freddy's glove. It grabs the mask and pulls it underground, which is a perfect setup for what all of the fans had for 10, 15 years been clamoring for. Uh-huh. You know, these two guys going at it. And Kane said, I'm going to be the glove. It's only going to be me. I don't want to hear anything more about it. I'm going to do it. And you find out a really interesting tidbit about a director some years earlier, many years earlier, named Wes Craven, sitting down with Kane and talking to him about wanting to do a movie with a killer who was burned and scarred. So they have this conversation. Yeah. So, in another world, in another life, it might have been that Kane actually had played Freddy or might have played both of them. Who knows? And Kane was very intrigued because after having gone through the accident and being burned, really incorporating that in a way where he wouldn't necessarily need to wear a mask. He wouldn't need to have, you know, a bunch of heavy makeup. That's what I inferred from what he said. But that was really cool. So we get up to Jason in space, and there are talks going back and forth. Now, I've heard many different stories from the director, from people at Paramount, people at New Line, Kane says essentially he's provided a script. He has lunch with one of the execs at New Line. They want to do Freddy and Jason. Obviously, he is ready to go, very excited, can't wait to put the mantle back on and to go at it with, by this point, somebody who has been a friend of his, and they've worked on other productions before, Robert Englund. And so everything seems to be set. Everything seems to be in motion, and at some point, and he still can't really give you a clear understanding about how that went, the role goes to Ken Kurtzinger, which is funny. Anyone who is a real fan of the Friday the 13th series knows that in Jason Takes Manhattan, Kurtzinger is in a scene in a diner. And Jason comes in, he's chasing our two heroes who have survived throughout the whole movie. And Kurtzinger comes from, he's a short order cook, I believe. He comes from behind the counter and is going to confront Jason. And Kane just grabs him and bodily throws him across the diner and just totals the guy. And then, you know, proceeds to stalk his prey. He is also, what I didn't know, he's also in a shot in an alley wearing the full costume, the whole getup, doing a car stunt where he's supposed to be hit by this police car. He hits the hood, rolls off. The concern was that they didn't want Kane to do the stunt because if he had gotten injured, that would have essentially tanked the rest of the movie. So Kurtzinger essentially, I believe, is on screen and Jason goes to Manhattan for about maybe 40 seconds in these two shots. And from that, they deem that that's enough to give him the role for Freddy versus Jason.
Interesting.
So, yeah, yeah. So, you know, again, obviously the gap here is a whole bunch of studio machinations and people moving things around and people making decisions. But Kane, and I believe him, he says, I've never given them a reason to not give me the role. Never showed up late, never been not professional, never been difficult. And if you look at the rest of his body of work, we're talking about a man who comes to the studio, you know, sits down in the chair, 3-4 hours of makeup. He tells a story about being in the prison production, about he's supposed to be in a electric chair, supposed to be one of these executed prisoners, come back to life, really great makeup, so he looks hideous. And they come up with an idea of having worms or night crawlers all over him. And he comes up with the suggestion, wouldn't it be cool if I had night crawlers coming out of my mouth? And they say, do you really, want to do this? And he says, yeah, sure. He gives me the impression of really all of the old school horror guys, you know, Savini, these guys who are putting things together on the fly, really creative, really doing their best and doing the work in a way that most people, I think, especially now, don't appreciate as much. There's an entire industry of people who are the gaffers, who are the carpenters, who are doing the hard work of making sure the production looks great and everything comes off without a hitch. I look at him as one of the old guard in that respect. So he does the role, works out well, he goes on to others. So it is really a missed opportunity not to have him in Freddy versus Jason. I think Kurtzinger did. I mean, obviously I saw the film. Who could not see that film? People getting thrown around. I think it was really well done. And they managed to satisfy, if, you know, 200 people in a screaming theater when I saw it, if they're any judge, they managed to do a good job in balancing both Freddy and Jason. If you've not seen it, whoever's listening, if you've not seen it, I'm not going to wreck it for you, but it's definitely up there in terms of the great horror matchups. So we have, at this point, his career essentially as Jason comes to a close. And it winds up being almost a blessing in disguise because he then parlays this to do other things. He does the Hatchet series. He does other work, several other different roles. He continues to work with Robert Englund and really becomes even more of a legend. And this is enhanced not only by his on-screen roles, but really the way in which he deals with fans. The horror industry has its moments where it explodes. You have somebody who has a new take on something where they come up with a really gross idea. You have the Saw series. You have the Hostel series. you have a bunch of different films that came out, remakes of, you know, Last House on the Left, I Spit on Your Grave. So you have those moments as a horror fan that you can hang your hat on. But sometimes there are very few and far between. So what you fill those moments in with are stories and smaller productions that you see people you are really big fans of, you see them doing, that kind of keep you going. And Kane has been a fixture on the convention circuit. He has been a fixture in doing charity work. A little known fact to some, perhaps, is that I didn't know that Kane is also a juggalo, which is just fascinating to me. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. There's a picture, I will send it to you, of an article where he talks about being stopped and harassed and they wind up almost going to jail, but doing some kind of offhand community service. But in that article, he is standing there wearing a Juggalo jersey, jeans, boots, and face paint, which is amazing. Now, recently, I've been watching some things here and there, documentaries about Juggalos and that whole movement, especially as it relates to free speech and their ability to gather for, once the gathering of the Juggalos happens every year, I think, being curtailed, and that being essentially attack on their free speech and their right to gather. And so him being a part of that is very interesting and gives you a little bit of insight in terms of, you know, this is not just, you know, a regular guy. You know, he's passionate about some things, he follows some things, and he really is his own person. So I thought that was really cool.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around Insane Clown Jason.
Yeah, and it's totally hilarious to see, but it really falls in line with the movie and what I know about his character. All in all, you know, a very good, kind, very considerate man. So a lot of the footage, in interspersing talking about his work in Hatchet and doing these other roles, which expanded because he wasn't slated to do more stuff in terms of Friday the 13th and Jason. So essentially, he gets a new life and still being able to do more and also transitioning from doing stunts and to real acting. So he takes the mask, the prosthetics, all the FX makeup off, and is able to show real range, real emotion. I never thought I would see Kane Hodder cry, and I never thought I would see him cry and it be meaningful and relatable, but I've seen him in 3-4 roles now where he plays a really, you know, compassionate character. You get real emotion, and it really comes through with the work that he's done. So the conventions, that period of the film shows him with kids, with burn victims, with people from all walks of life. And Bruce Campbell says that these people are looking for something in connecting with the people that they follow, the people who are their giant fans of. And it's a little different than, say, for instance, a Comic-Con or a Star Trek convention necessarily, mm-hmm. because they're looking, they are all also looking for an experience, but it is a very kind of personal thing for them. And Kane delivers every single time. So that is really awesome to know about him as a performer, as an individual. So all of these things, I think, make him a really well-rounded, very compelling actor and person, in addition to the roles that he's played, which can be mistaken for being gory or this or that, but it takes real intuition and it takes real character, not just to be the end product of what people are seeing, but go through the process, being willing to work with directors, being so fastidious about how he works that in very few of his films, he doesn't hang out with the other actors. So, you know, you're not, you know, standing next to Jason at the craft services table and chatting. He essentially sequesters himself from the other actors so that when they do their scene, they feel it. It is actual terror. It is actual, you know, fumbling around for this prop, running, maybe a little too fast out of the shot. and really being mindful of that and creating the atmosphere before he even steps on set, which is really fantastic. He strikes me also kind of like, you know, a Boris Karloff, somebody who is really in the process, who melds with the makeup to produce something that's indelible. So it transitions from his growing up to him entering the stunt industry, to him transitioning to acting, him gaining and then losing the role of Jason, and then the aftermath of doing all these different roles which allow him to grow and expand, and talks about his family, his two sons, his wife, who I've never heard about, never seen, was always fixated on him and the roles that he was doing. So that was a really nice component to see, in addition to the people who he's worked with in the industry, people who have asked him to do certain things, and people who were able to finally actually get this piece of work made to really allow him to sit down and tell things that he has never told anyone, to really be human, to fill in all the blanks that fans would have about him, the roles, and his long history of being in the business and what he's learned and the connections that he's made.
Cool.
Yeah.
How much, I know you're familiar with the documentary, about Friday the 13th. Was there any overlap in terms of story or background between that documentary and this one?
You mean Crystal Lake Memories, or his name was Jason?
I think it was Crystal Lake Memories. That's the really long one that was like 3 hours long.
Yeah. This was interesting because it really just focused on Kane. In fact, the cinematography is very interesting because it reminds me a lot of a graphic novel. There are voiceovers and periods in which he's talking about parts of his career where he's walking this landscape. It's a burned and scarred landscape. So as a comic book head, this is very reminiscent. So visually, it's very intriguing and it pulls you in. But Crystal Lake Memories is more of a comprehensive thing. So it talks to Sean Cunningham, talks to the actors, the directors. In parts, it touches on the actors who play Jason. But this was very much Kane-driven. So there was not a lot of room to go into each individual movie or the actors that were part of it.
So somebody who's interested in a documentary won't be turned off by there being too much overlap. This is all like 99% new stuff.
Yeah. There may be some things that people who have dug around or who really have their thumb on the pulse of what's going on with these actors may know, but I believe that the thrust for the Indiegogo project was to really get stuff that people didn't know about and to involve people who have worked with Kane and have experiences to relate and really positive things to say about him.
Cool. Now, after the film, was there a Q&A session where any of the filmmakers there? Was Kane himself there?
That would have been the first thing I said. Oh my God, I met Kane Hodder. Oh my God. No, because I would love to have been choked by Kane Hodder. That would have been absolutely awesome. No, he was not there. It was the East Coast premiere, but it was a very intimate venue where I've actually read all of the reviews of the people who came and participated. So it was a very small venue. There wasn't time for Q&A. None of the principals who put the film together or got it out or got it funded were there. So that was a missed opportunity that the film festival could have involved them if that was possible. I don't even know for them if that was.
Something I learned this past weekend, I'm not sure that would have been possible because To Hell and Back also had a premiere at Screamfest LA the same time.
Yeah, so New York was definitely going to lose out to that.
Yeah.
You have home court advantage. Everyone, it would have been out there, so they would have been easily able to attend that, whereas this was, but still, it was a really good little nugget of information to know and to experience. So if there's an opportunity to buy it, I'm definitely going to buy it, add that to my collection. It'll sit next to my hardcover book of Crystal Lake Memories, so yeah.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I know, I'm trying to remember, okay, Scares That Care. There is a charity convention called Scares That Care. Brian Keene, who everyone knows is a very famous horror writer, he, I think, is one of the co-founders. And every year, I think it's in Williamsburg, Virginia, every year they hold this convention. It's for the fans, and they bring out celebrities and they raise money to give to three families in need. And one of those families is someone who, I think it's a burn victim or a child who's a burn victim. Mm-hmm. And I know that he has been there at least once, maybe more than once. Mm-hmm. But when you were talking about how he interacts with the fans, how he's going out there doing stuff for them, I thought, he was at that Scares That Care. So I think that's already happened this year, but for next year...
It's happening next year, August 3rd to the 5th.
There you go.
It'll be in Williamsburg. It's going to be at the Doubletree by the Hilton. So, folks, if you want to see that, there's your dates in the venue.
So that's something you keep up with.
Yes. Despite my not being able to go to a lot of them, I still keep up with it to try to see if, you know, if is this going to be the year that you go and you spend a bunch of money and go halfway across the country to do that? Yeah, I try to keep up on that because I don't read Fangoria anymore. You know, some things you grow out of.
Oh, boy. Oh, well. So in your recommendation, anyone who's a horror fan, anyone who's a Kane Hodder fan should definitely go check this out. If it appears in their neck of the woods or when it comes out on streaming or DVD.
Absolutely. Go out and get it, watch it, watch it again. It will fill out some of your understanding. I think Kane Hodder's the definitive Jason. He redid the role, he brought it forward, and really loves his work. So if you're a fan, definitely see it. You want to know a little bit more, you want to get a little bit more, you know, under the mask, so to speak, this is definitely for you.
Cool. And we will keep everybody up to date on next year's Brooklyn Horror Film Fest when it comes around. Maybe we'll get you in to see a few a wide variety of horror fare. How's that sound?
Absolutely, I'd love it.
Okay, hang on a second. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Hey guys, this is Arjun Gupta from Sci-Fi's The Magician. You are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
And that's our horror talk. Hopefully this will be a good out for October, for Halloween, to just to wrap up the plethora of film festivals that we did cover. Didn't even get anywhere near all of them. Any other final Halloween hints or horror tips you want to give the listeners?
Not really. But obviously there's a ton of stuff happening, and I'm in New York, so there's the Halloween parade, which is always fantastic. It's huge. But get out there, you know, read, watch, whatever you can get your hands on.
Anything special you're watching on television? I know Exorcist just started back up, and a lot of people are happy that that got renewed.
Mm-hmm. Here and there, not very much. A lot of your recommendations, I'm still going through and watching those. So that takes time. I'm really looking forward to Stranger Things. I cannot say that enough. I had a blast watching it last year. I really think they're going to do some interesting, cool stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. And there are some things on Netflix here and there, some small Tales of Halloween.
Yes.
And of course, the yearly going through, you know, the old Halloween movies and watching those, which are always fun.
What has surprised me is the explosion of Christmas themed horror movies. I'm like, really? Seriously? Y'all have that much Christmas drama?
I think people are working through some stuff. Absolutely. Krampus came out, was it early this year or last year, which was a big hit with a lot of my friends. So there's a whole lot of stuff there to unpack. Maybe people are getting tired of Halloween and they're trying to horrorize other holidays, which is funny.
The fact that Halloween decorations appeared in the grocery stores in August before Labor Day, I had to stop and just say, okay, we might be crossing a threshold here.
Especially considering who needs an excuse to get candy corn that early. I mean, really, at this point, it's kind of ridiculous. All the Halloween superstores are starting to open, you know, the pop-up superstores. So that's always fun. That is fun to do during the season. There's one on Broadway, the Halloween Superstore, and you go through there, and that's fun to hang out and watch. But other than that, I am really looking forward to actually cooler weather so it feels like Halloween. So all of those things combined really get me in the spirit of the season.
Yeah, I never thought about it. What happens if it's too hot to do a decent costume?
Then you wear less, I guess. I mean, that's not much of an excuse for most people because they'll wear less anyway, but
true.
Really kind of dampens things down if it's balmy outside.
Well, we will have some horror recommendations beyond To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story. You'll have my recommendations. You'll have some from Jonathan. Thanks, Jonathan, for joining us today to talk horror.
Absolutely. It was awesome.
And if you have any questions or comments, please call. The number is 602-635-6976. Or you can shoot me an email, summer@sliceofsci-fi.com. You can leave a comment, leave a voicemail message. I do respond to all your requests and comments, so chat me up. Let's have some fun. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. And if you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, please leave a review. Let us know how we're doing for you. Every review also helps other people find the show, so please leave a review if you can. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube and on Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. And as always, there is the website, sliceofsci-fi.com. Leave a comment on any of our reviews or commentary there. You can even leave your own star rating if you don't agree with ours. How's that for starting up a good friendly geek argument? Yeah, we have some new reviews coming up. And of course, everyone's looking forward to the new Marvel movies, the Star Wars movie this December. People are...
Absolutely.
Excited about that. If you want to check out any literary coverage we have, that's over at writersafterdark.com. We have new Star Wars audiobooks come in, the Shakespeare one, and there was another new one. I don't have reviewers for those yet. I really don't. Maybe someone I know could volunteer to do an audiobook review for Shakespeare, the next Shakespeare Star Wars book. What do you think?
It sounds good. Definitely possible. Yeah.
I'd like to thank everyone who is submitting, who is pledging their support through Patreon to Slice of Sci-Fi. Every dime helps. I literally cannot express deeply enough how much you guys are helping out. So thank you. If you want to also pledge your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. I'd also like to throw out my shout out of love to my favorite geek rock band, Sci Fried, for the music they adorn the show with. Their new album is coming out soon, and I just did an interview with them. Oh my God. The album is awesome. It is creative and funny and just hard driving rock and roll like I like it. And they've ratcheted up the humor in a couple of songs. Just saying. I will not drop any spoilers yet, but you will be entertained. In any case, thank you for your time, Jonathan, and sharing your horror knowledge with us.
Such that it is. I had a blast. Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.